When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by your CFRC News Collective, Ara McCauley, Jesse Bell, and Jenny Hinch. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Ara McCauley, and here are your local news headlines. Paige Agnew, the city's Commissioner of Growth and Development Services, and Kyle Compo, Director of Licensing Enforcement Services for the City of Kingston, presented City Council with an outline of the roles and objectives, along with a sneak peek at the uniform design, of the new Municipal Special Constable Program, which will begin its rollout with 8 personnel on July 1st.
Mr. Compo and I are here tonight to talk to you about the Special Constable Program. We were last here about a year ago, and we've been working on the implementation strategy ever since. Very excited. We've had a number of months of training, and we'll have a complement of 8 special constables that will be starting work as of July 1st.
This evening, we are pleased to present the Municipal Special Constable Report to Council. This report represents the final stages of implementing a program that has been under development for some time and is intended to enhance community safety, improve support to frontline enforcement operations, and provide an additional level of service within municipal facilities, parks, and public spaces.
Described as a targeted support-based enhancement of existing enforcement services, the Special Constable Program will offer direct support to bylaw officers in the field, enforcement support within municipal parks, including encampments, and increased visibility in high-demand areas where community concerns have been consistently raised, such as weekend events downtown, statutory holidays, and what the report describes as emerging or trending areas of concern identified through public complaints, calls for service, and operational intelligence in order to support proactive engagement, deter non-compliant behavior, and provide reassurances to residents, businesses, and visitors within the community.
The initial implementation of the program will focus primarily on authorities under the Trespass to Property Act and supporting municipal enforcement officers in the field. This approach will allow the city to establish a program in a measured and responsible manner while focusing on municipal properties and facilities where staff regularly respond to trespass and public safety concerns.
The Trespass to Property Act, TPA, governs unauthorized entry onto private property, including land, buildings, boats, and trailers. It grants property owners and occupiers the legal right to issue warnings orally or in writing, such as a no trespassing sign or red paint on the borders of a property line, and remove individuals who refuse to leave or engage in prohibited activity on their property, carrying fines of up to $10,000. The law allows property owners or their agents, such as security guards, to ask a trespasser to leave and use, quote, a reasonable amount of force to remove them if they refuse. The city expects the program will enhance its ability to respond to non-criminal enforcement matters on city property more effectively in situations where additional authority or support is required beyond what is typically available through bylaw enforcement alone. In the report, city staff noted that the program will maintain a focused and measured scope in its first year of implementation, tempering expectations from community and stakeholders during a period of evolving demand and limited municipal resources.
Success will not be measured solely through enforcement statistics. Staff will monitor the program through a number of different performance measures, including proactive patrols, calls for service, support provided to municipal law enforcement officers, response times, community engagement activities, and overall impacts in service delivery. This program is really establishing the focus on building positive relationships. The goal is to provide a visible, professional, and accountable public safety presence while supporting compliance, enhancing staff and public safety, and helping ensure municipal facilities and public spaces remain safe and accessible for everyone. We're confident that the implementation of this program will improve service delivery, increase staff and public safety, and provide the city with an additional tool to address issues occurring on municipal property.
In addition to enforcement support within municipal parks, special constables will offer direct support to bylaw officers, providing assistance on calls for service and, in what the city calls a critical component of the program, provide support in situations that may escalate and enhance overall officer safety.
A key objective of this program is to improve officer safety and enhance our ability to respond to situations that increasingly involve complex social issues, encampment-related concerns, unauthorized access to municipal properties, and other matters occurring in public spaces.
At Council, Kyle Compo modeled the new uniform, which drew concerns from Councillor McLaren, who worried about the message being sent by the constable's appearance, noting the intimidation factor of the dark gray outfit. In addition to the uniform's colors, questions also arose about what personal protective equipment, PPE, special constables would be equipped with. Wording in the report was vague, noting ballistic vests, communication equipment, and, quote, additional PPE tools where appropriate.
Thank you. Uniform is impressively scary. It's quite intimidating. May I ask, what do you have in your utility belt?
Thank you for the question, Councilor McLaren. We've got handcuffs, we've got OC spray, so pepper spray, and we carry a baton. So those are what we've been granted through the Police Services Board. That's in relation to what we've seen with other municipalities as well. In terms of the uniform itself, there's been a lot of conversation around our uniforms. There are provincial requirements where you can't look identical to a police officer, but we have to stand out in terms of an enforcement service. So there's sort of like that mix again between police officer, as you see aside, would be in a black uniform, our bylaw officer in blue. Some mental health services are in red. So from right now, with consultation with Kingston Police, we've decided on a gray uniform.
Has any thought been given to the lightness of your gray color with regards to the stated goal of de-escalation? Because I understand that dark colors from, color psychology tend to be more aggressive and tend to be more escalatory rather than de-escalatory.
We've sort of had a mix of our uniforms. We also have white officer shirts. I would say first and foremost is our jackets and any kind of outer material are in yellow for high visibility.
Councillor Sanek asked about the constable's ability to use force and whether they would be proactive in seeking out individuals who might be breaking laws or simply working in a support capacity as called upon.
So a bylaw officer can't use force, but a police officer can. Can you use more force than a bylaw officer?
We have delegated authority through the Kingston Police Services Board, and those are for very defined provincial statutes that speak to what we can and cannot do. So one of them would be, for instance, the Trespass to Property Act. And for bylaw officers right now, where they're into situations, they don't have arrest authorities and they don't have advanced PPE that they could defend themselves with. For special constables, we now do, under that provision, have an arrest authority where we could potentially arrest somebody in the worst case scenario.
How proactive is it going to be? Like, are you still going to be, as a special constable, reporting to complaints?
So yeah, going to be providing some data in terms of, again, potentially the number of calls that are going away from Kingston Police that we're able to respond to on behalf of bylaw officers that are in these situations. So there is going to be some data that we're going to be able to share publicly. We are working through that for July 1st, is that we're going to have a city website that's dedicated to the special constable program, providing forward-facing information on data, statistics, reporting, and what this program's all about. And in terms of proactive enforcement, we would be on a, hand-in-hand partnership with our bylaw officers. So our bylaw officers are still frontline officers. We would be that supporting mechanism. So we're not necessarily going out trying to get involved in other situations, but we do want to be a visible presence. So we're looking at, events that are in the downtown, maybe movies in the square or promenade or buskers, our major events, tourism activities. Again, it would be reactive and based on working with our bylaw officers.
While municipal special constables will have authority to exercise certain police powers under the direction of a police officer to enforce certain parts of the Trespass to Property Act, Mental Health Act, Liquor License Act, and the Safe Streets Act, the report was clear in outlining what roles the municipal special constables are not intended to fulfill, noting they will not operate 24/7 or actively enforce the criminal code, including undertaking criminal investigations, arrests, emergency response, or high-risk situations, all of which will continue to fall under the scope of Kingston Police.
It is important to note that municipal special constables are not police officers, nor are they intended to replace the role of Kingston Police. Rather, they are to provide a specialized level of enforcement that bridges the gap between traditional municipal bylaw enforcement and policing. The program is not intended to be a 24-hour emergency response service. Outside of those hours, the Kingston Police Service will continue to respond as they do today.
Instead, the program will emphasize supporting municipal enforcement operations, particularly in municipal parks and the downtown core, Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. and on weekends from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. to align with peak demand periods. As the pilot program is being delivered through the city's existing enforcement management team, the special constables consist of six existing supervisors who already oversee property standards, bylaw, and parking enforcement, limiting the city's ability to provide continuous coverage, particularly during weekends and evenings. Further questions from Councillors Tozo and Amos arose around the constable's training, related to both job-specific skills and mental health support and burnout prevention for officers.
They have completed the required training. We're just at the final stages with the rest of our supervisors right now, and we will continue to receive ongoing training in regards to de-escalation, mental health awareness, community engagement, and safe exercise of their authorities.
Could you talk a little bit about the amount of training or the types of courses that the eight special constables have now been engaged in?
There are provincial examinations that special constables have to go through. So there's actually a requirement from the province. So it's about a 4 to 5 week course that some of our staff are on right now with the provincial examination at the end. So that focuses on using all the PPE and the defense tactics and things like that, but it also really focuses on mental health, trauma-informed training, de-escalation tactics, communication. Those are part of the provincial legislations that we have to go through for our examinations. We're really focusing on that trauma, mental health training that we can provide to our officers, again, in crisis situations, and that's what, again, our focus outside of the provincial mandate is those areas right now.
That's perfect. That's exactly what we're hoping for, I think, as a council, is that de-escalation and the mental health aspects and the communication aspects. It's well done.
There are going to be tabs on special constables as well and their mental health and how they're doing on the job as well, because we don't want burnout. And certainly if you're going to be in much more challenging situations, which bylaw is already in, that's going to be a parameter of this. So there will be wellness checks, correct?
Through yes, there will be.
Obviously, when a special constable becomes engaged in an escalated situation, the mental health aspect is very important for that special constable in a debriefing afterwards. Do we have it set in our procedures for those special constables to have a debrief? Is there a procedure in place to protect all eight of you?
There are SOPs in place, so standard operating procedures that we have in place, where if a special constable is dealing with that kind of situation, that they'd be able to go through a process to get support. So we are very aware, for lack of a better term, of the situations and the mental fatigue that our officers can go through. We're putting procedures in place, but we're working with our staff to develop these as well.
The report itself made special note of the city's coordinated encampment response, which they describe as a service-first approach, stating that enforcement alone is not an effective or appropriate tool to address complex social needs. Currently, bylaw enforcement officers offer operational support to other city departments during site visits, inspections, public work cleanups, and other coordinated responses where staff safety, site conditions, or escalation concerns may be present. The city's established encampment protocol includes an initial focus on engagement, de-escalation, and connecting individuals to appropriate supports, including street outreach partners, before enforcement action is considered. While the city collaborates with home-based housing and addiction and mental health services, street outreach services are currently limited to weekends between 8:30 a.m. and 6 p.m., with only two dedicated outreach workers available to respond to calls for service citywide, with none being exclusively assigned to encampment-related calls. The special constable program is being described as an additional tool in a coordinated effort between bylaw enforcement services, street outreach providers, and community partners for situations that require an enhanced response, including in situations where individuals decline support services and where there are clear and immediate health and safety risks, which the city describes as balancing compassion with compliance. The report notes that public consultation is not a legislated requirement for this program, with development based based on internal consultation and identification of service gaps. Still, the city laid out opportunities for engagement, ranging from educating the public on the role of municipal special constables, outreach to interest groups, including community groups, and targeted engagement with vulnerable populations and advocacy organizations with feedback informing future program adjustments and expansion considerations. Something Councillor Tozo asked about in council as well.
Do you have a really interesting defined success criteria in year one? Is council going to be informed periodically about the metrics that you're using to define success and some sort of parameters and how this is done year upon year?
Yes, we would be providing statistics back to council. We'd be providing updates just on the program, how we're defining success. And again, around those statistics, we're really looking at the relationship building with members of the community. And that's hopefully going to be shown back to you through council, through discussions with residents.
Pressing concerns around indigenization, inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility, IIDEA, the report notes that all municipal special constables assigned to the program will receive training grounded in IIDEA principles to support staff in carrying out their duties in a professional, respectful, and community-focused manner while recognizing the diverse needs and lived experience of individuals encountered during enforcement interactions, citing the importance of culturally informed and trauma-aware approaches.
We're really focusing on the public engagement, getting interactions with different stakeholders to make sure they're aware of what the program is. And we're working with our director of IIDA. Again, when a special constable goes into a situation, our role is not just directly enforcement. It's about communication, presenting ourselves in a professional way, but we're really continuing to work with our outreach partners and getting people into the proper services that they need. So that's going to be part of the conversations that we're having daily with individuals. It might look intimidating. It's also an enforcement service, but we are really focused on delivering that message that we're here to support bylaw officers, but get people the services that they need.
Councillor Amos commended the program at the end of the staff's presentation.
Obviously, there was a lot of fearfulness from the public in certain aspects of this and misunderstanding and confusion. I think you've provided that guidance, and judging by what you have indicated with the report today, I think it's heading in the right step. So well done to you and your team.
That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Sports Desk.
It was an eventful weekend football-wise here in the city of Kingston as the Kingston Grenadiers had three home games on Saturday at Richardson Memorial Stadium. In the first of three games, the U16 AAA squad defeated Huronia by a score of 16-14 on a last-minute field goal, a clutch kick made by a high school-age kid. Certainly will get the scouts taking notice. In the second game, the AAA U18 Grenadiers had a much easier time with their opponents, winning handedly 48-10 over Sault Ste. Marie, locking up first place in the Eastern Division for the Kingston Grenadiers U18 squad. And then in the closer, the U14 Grenadiers had a hard-fought defensive stalemate of a 12-6 victory over the Durham Dolphins. A huge victory for the U14 squad as they look to fight for playoff positioning in the Ontario Summer Football League. Shifting our focus now to national sports leagues, it's a tale of two series in regards to the NBA and NHL finals. In the NBA, the New York Knicks have a 2-0 lead over the San Antonio Spurs with a chance to close out the series with a 4-0 sweep at home. Now, there's a lot of ground to cover before New York can get into that sweep situation, but taking two games on the road over the favored Spurs puts them in an ideal position to bring the first NBA title back to New York in almost 60 years. Tip-off for the crucial Game 3 is tonight at 8:30 p.m. The Stanley Cup Finals have been a much closer series, at least So far, as we approach Game 4, the Vegas Golden Knights took Game 1 by a score of 5-4. The Carolina Hurricanes took Game 2 in overtime by a 4-3 mark. And then the last game these two teams played went to double overtime in a truly remarkable contest that saw each team score 4 unanswered goals before eventually heading into overtime, at which point Vegas was able to score the decider to win 5-4 and take a 2-1 series lead. Game 4 will have its puck dropped on Tuesday, and this could be the crucial game. If Vegas is able to win, they take a stranglehold in the series. If Carolina can fight back, we could be looking at a 7-game all-time classic Stanley Cup final. That's a wrap on your sports report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. Coming up next, I've got your weather and traffic report for the region. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Monday, June 8th. Beautiful day here in the city of Kingston, daytime high of 26 degrees with sunny conditions all day long, dropping down to 14 overnight. Tuesday, June 9th, the warmest day of the year so far here in the Limestone City. Sunny conditions, daytime high of 30 degrees, but it is going to cool off a little bit overnight as we have a 60% chance of precipitation in the forecast. Wednesday, June 10th, 27 is your high with a 40% chance of rain, dropping down to a 30% chance of precipitation overnight and a low of 17. Thursday, June 11th, another hot day, the start of a run of warm weather. 29 is your high with a 30% chance of rain, only going down to 22 overnight, so it's going to be quite warm even overnight here in the city of Kingston. Friday, June 12th, 29 degrees is your high with a 30% chance of rain, dropping down to 16 degrees and cloudy overnight. Saturday, June 13th, just in time for Pride here in the city of Kingston, we have got a beautiful 27 degree day with a mix of sun and cloud. Sunday, June 14th, there is a 40% chance of rain in the forecast with a high of 26. And then kicking off next week, Monday, June 15th, 27 is your high with a 45% chance of rain. Moving now to your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. On Bath Road between Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard and Portsmouth Avenue, expect delays as crews continue installing intersection pedestrian signals. Over on King Street from Country Club Drive to Front Road, expect delays as Utilities Kingston work has reduced traffic to one lane each direction. Watch for lane shifts, reduced speeds, and shared lane signage. Cranbrook Street from Days Road to Lakeview Avenue will be closed from 8:40 to 9:20 a.m. in the morning and 3:20 to 3:50 p.m. in the afternoon as part of the School Streets program, restricting access during school drop-off and pickup times. Bright Crescent remains closed between Palace Road and Kingsland Crescent for roadway repairs and safety improvements. Construction continues on Princess Street from Frontenac to Division as part of a major reconstruction project. Long-term closures remain in place on Aberdeen Street between Johnson and William and Barry and Queen. And Sydenham Street is closed to through traffic between Princess and Queen for the Sydenham Street Community Space. On-street parking on Sydenham Street does, however, remain available. That's a wrap for weather and traffic. Let's send it over to Genevieve Hinch for CFRC's concert and events calendar.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario, I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny, and this is your weekly events and concerts calendar brought to you by Flying V Productions. Whether you're looking for live music, Pride celebrations, community festivals, workshop theaters, or just something fun to do around the city, there's plenty happening this week, so let's get into it. Starting off Monday, things are fairly quiet around the city, but families can head over to Calvin Park Branch for Stories in the Garden from 10:30 to 11 a.m. Later in the evening, jazz fans can check out Jazz Mondays at the RCHA Club featuring Inner Harbor Jazz and Oscar Evans from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m., while the Morning Doves take over Musiki Cafe from 8 to 11 p.m. Trivia also returns to Something in the Water Brewing Company from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesday brings a mix of creativity and Pride Month celebrations. The Tet Center opens its Piece Together exhibition from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., while Calvin Park Branch hosts a digital marketing essentials workshop at noon. Later that evening, Drag in the Park takes over Confederation Park from 7 to 9 p.m., bringing live performances and community celebrations outdoors. Music fans can also catch Eric Uren and Megan Boulogne at the Cove Inn or stop by Musiki Cafe's weekly open mic night. On Wednesday, community events take center stage. Teens can head to Rideau Heights Branch for games and grub in the afternoon, while Kingston Nexus hosts a board game night beginning at 6 p.m. The Ground Up Dance Festival arrives at the Theatre La Sesame at 7 p.m. and showcasing contemporary dance and performances from across the region. Live music highlights include Glenn Jones, Liam Grant, and Jack Pine performing at Something Else Records, while Dan Byrne and Orit Shimoni take the stage at the Broom Factory later that evening. Thursday definitely keeps things busy with the Kingston Public Market running all day in Springer Market Square. The Central Branch Library hosts a Get Ready for Pride workshop, while Calvin Park Branch presents Roots and Remedies, exploring Indigenous teachings and traditions. In the evening, Drag Bingo returns to Daft Brewing from 7 to 11 p.m. Live music includes Mallory Chipman at the Cove Inn, Ted Lalonde at Time Out Bar, and KBS Monthly Jam at the RCHA Club. Friday is packed with entertainment across the city. Musiki Cafe hosts its live drag and burlesque from 5 to 7 p.m., while The Spire welcomes Canadian comedy and musical favorites The Arrogant Worms for a concert and music talk beginning at 7. Live music includes Orkstar Criminal at Hotel Wolf Island, Morgan Davis at the RCHA Club, and local favorite Squid Pistol performing at the Merchant Tap House later that night. Saturday is heading into Pride Weekend in Kingston. The community fair runs at Confederation Park from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., while Kingston Pride Parade begins at noon at the Memorial Center. Other highlights include YGK Beer Fest at Fort Henry, the Ukraine Folklore Festival at Regie, and an Ontario Serendipity Tour documentary screening at the Tet Center. In the evening, visitors can hop aboard the Out on the Queen Pride Boat Cruise. Catch comedian Jeff McHenry and at Daft Brewing, or dance the night away at Glow After Dark at La Vida Bistro and the Gay Pride Dance Party at Bottoms Up. Wrapping things up on Sunday, the Memorial Center Farmers Market runs from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. The Kingston Pride Recovery Brunch takes place at Wharf and Feather beginning at noon, and nature lovers can join a guided walk with KNCLN starting at 10:30 a.m. Live music includes Hawksley Workman and the Wolves at Signal Brewery, followed by Head Over Heels performing at the Cove Inn's waterside patio. This has been your weekly events and concerts calendar for June 8th through the 14th. And for more information on any of these events, visit the CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. This events calendar is brought to you by Flying V Productions, bringing live theater, comedy, and unforgettable entertainment to audiences across Kingston. Be sure to check out their upcoming shows and events throughout the season. I'm Jenny, and thanks so much for listening. And have a great week, Kingston.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic, every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 320. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with Emil Jansson, who is an author, a musician, a community organizer based between the United States and South Africa. Emil is known for his work in connecting social movements and hip-hop culture, known as Emil YX, a pioneering South African hip-hop activist. He was part of the Black Noise Ensemble and has been involved in an initiative called Heal the Hood. Emil has authored a number of books, including Making a Black Noise Part 1, a book for youth, and he has also authored My Hip-Hop is Africa and Proud. That came out in 2024, and it's a look at the African roots and global impact of hip-hop culture in the South African context and beyond. And honestly, there are a number of different titles that Emil has written, so I encourage you to look them up. His website is emilyx.com. In this conversation, we talk about a number of intersecting points, looking at the capacity for art, poetry, hip-hop to create reflection, and it also having a healing capacity for communities that have experienced structural violence and systemic racism that is looked at in the context of South Africa, but also in the United States and beyond. And this is not the first time I've talked to Emil on the program. It's always a pleasure to speak with him. And I will just share now the conversation that we had on this edition of Free City Radio.
In a way, right now, it seems that some of the recognition that grassroots arts expression and, you know, they're linked to social movements all around the world, that had some recognition recently. We're talking about, let's say, street art or hip hop culture. There was, I think, a feeling that the sort of recognition was something that was going to remain. But as we're seeing this rise in extreme right nationalism, a lot of the efforts to push for both the artists and community organizations that were on the front lines of pushing for, you know, cultural expression at the grassroots level to be recognized are facing this new attack on a cultural level, on a political level. And so it's a really interesting time to speak to you, I think, Emil, about your work, of course, in Cape Town and also in other parts of South Africa. As a hip-hop artist, a young hip-hop artist, you know, you were involved in youth culture in the context of apartheid, and after that have made a link also to a hip-hop culture in the United States. You've recently published a book, so we want to get into that, but maybe we could just first start by a brief introduction and also any reflections you have on this point.
I think when art is a very powerful tool, and I wasn't really surprised that like funding got cut for like progressive thinkers and artists, you know, because artists, they on the ground and they in the communities mostly. And so arming that community is almost detrimental to capital, you know. And so I didn't expect them to be happy about us trying to implement, like, alternative thinking, right? Because if you look at, like, what the books that have been banned and what's the DEI and all of the other things that are happening in the United States, it's almost a repetition to a great extent of, like, the limitations placed on information in South Africa during apartheid or even during Nazi Germany's time of rule. It's a very similar attempt at erasure. And also it's a show of power, like, you know, that they will wield that power in the same way, using economics, obviously, and the new platforms and streaming platforms to achieve their goal. And so, like, I was hoping it wouldn't happen. I was hoping that we'd, you know, you always have hope that all of the gains that were there, that there were, would be would still be able to flow the way it is, you know. And so what the other side of it is also that at the same time I've been writing a lot, and so I've you know, like, writing the most recent full document of, like, 1982 to 1995 of the work that I've done through Black Noise and through hip hop in Cape Town, but also paralleling apartheid, because it was during apartheid. And then, like, while looking at that, like, seeing all of this, I'm like, damn, it's like history repeating itself, you know. And you know, like, so it's sort of sobering but also sad, because I feel like I just told my wife earlier today, I feel like I'm stuck under the rule of, like, P.W. Buerta or John Foster, the apartheid guys, right? Because it just seems like that same energy. But it's also, like, a good feeling to, like, know that you weren't insane, you know, that you, because the way people sell it now is that, you know, things are exactly like it was in South Africa, which is the furthest from the truth, you know. Yes, there's going to be struggles, and obviously, like, the people of Venezuela are struggling, but the struggles that you as your sovereign country is supposed to be trying to solve yourself. And so I think that, like, has helped me to become a bit more, like, focused on the importance of documenting the past, but have it in parallel with the present, you know, like, the because you also have a situation where the sons of the beneficiaries of apartheid are now, like, here, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel are both key figures in the United States government, you know, and their role, obviously, that they didn't learn a thing, you know, they're just perpetuating what their ancestors wanted to do, you know. So I'm in an awkward place as well. But also, like I said, very sobering. It's an awkward place, but it's not unfamiliar, you know. And I think it's also a situation where I feel I have to speak about it, because a lot of people didn't live through it, and so they don't necessarily know. Like, this generation of hip hoppers don't necessarily know what was, in order for them to not fall prey to, like, all of these online, what do you call them, influences, you know, redefining and sort of erasing the truth.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of threads to what you talked about, Emil. So I want to get into them. You mentioned Black Noise, which is a hip-hop crew, b-boy crew that you were involved in Cape Town. And also, of course, you shared and shared community in different parts of South Africa. And you also, like, mentioned a totally different thread of South Africa. And you highlighted these tech billionaires, Peter Thiel and Elon Musk, which I think it's really important for people to... There's been some sort of... writing and discussion about this link of intergenerational wealth that they're benefiting from and sort of perpetuating through their actions, as they are white South Africans. Maybe you could contrast these two sort of voices from South Africa and how that sort of speaks to the importance of mobilizing intergenerational memory, which is connected, of course, to the writing that you've been doing.
Yeah, I think there's also, like, the lessons that I'm learning as I'm documenting this is that these platforms are actually spaces where young people are getting the information from. And so, you know, I was just part of a documentary screening of In the Hour of Chaos that Sami Alim screened at Howard University. And while watching it, I was like, yo, it's not the first time I saw it, but, like, I was like, we need to package this, you know, because kids, like, the attention span is so short, you know. So how do you take the best pieces and, like, put it on those spaces so you can counter the narrative? Or even encourage kids to be like, how do they create their own space where alternative voices can you know, be amplified and be a challenge to what exists? And so that's happening simultaneously while I'm... Because as soon as you speak to young people, you realize, like, that you're from a different generation, right? You're speaking vinyl and CDs, and they like, what are you talking about? But at the same time, like, there's those things that they, like, I feel like they assume that putting their music out for free will get global reach. And so when you break it down about, like, what the algorithms allow, it's within the realm of where they are, and they're like, yo, we didn't think about what's really going on behind the scenes, like, who's really controlling the platform, what is allowed to be said, you know, and like, how's that benefiting us economically? So at the same time that I'm documenting, I'm also learning from the next generation, like, how the stories, like, if it's a 26-minute documentary, how do you break it down into 26 minutes? You know, because maybe that's all they can handle, right? and then give it in that manner, you know, with opportunity to then interact after shorter periods of time, instead of waiting for, like, you know, here's a minute, let's unpack that minute, here's another, you know what I mean? Instead of like, yeah, watch this whole thing. If you're still awake by the end of it, if we haven't lost you, then let's talk then, which is already too late because they've, you know, so all of that is happening like in real time. So I'm learning from being around this younger generation, and they are the press the button and have a result generation. So they want to see that there's change. But you have to show them. You know what I mean? That you it's not just about talking. Like, so my b-boy background makes it easier, because, you know, like, as a b-boy, you had to show. You spend less time talking, you had to do, you know? And so all of that is happening while at the same time, they don't know the histories that brought about these people, you know? And so you have to find ways of addressing, like, that past in a way that they can understand, and also make them real. Because they are aware of the fact that at a certain point, they have to pay for having access to broader audience. And so when you break it down to them that these guys have money from, like, the exploitation they did in the past, and now you also going to spend your money with them, you know, and that your very limited resources is based on this history that caused your lack of access, you know. So it's a back and forth to a great extent. And they also, like, were led to believe that these guys like Elon are amazing South Africans who, you know, against all odds, made it in the USA. Because that's how that's been marketed and sold to them, you know. And so that's, like, you have multiple conversations happening simultaneously to like, demystify what these platforms have made so easy for young people to access, you know. They'll go to the extent of saying stuff like, yeah, but knowledge and information is freely available. And then you say, but who's knowledge and information, and who's the beneficiaries of this? Then they're like, oh shoot, damn, you know. So it's a back and forth that our generation, unfortunately, like, we have to do in person a lot of the times, but where we can, I think, like, the young people are teaching us how to do it online, you know, which is not easy for old ass people like me, but I'm trying. Yeah.
Well, you bring forth, like, a really interesting point, and Black Noise and your experience of being in person, right? And I think even today, 2026, the real power of people being in person, like, let's take, for example, the Gaza solidarity encampments when people are together, or the anti-police violence protests, the Black Lives Matter movement, when people actually gather across generations, Gen Z, Gen X, millennials, etc., and find ways to act together, whether it's creatively or collectively on the streets, that is also when power gets nervous.
Yeah, of course. And it always has been. I think that, like, I almost feel like COVID was a test period to see how much we believe what's online and how much we, you know, how much can be shared and be seen as normal, you know. Like, don't go to the festival, you can stream it, you know. But when you actually in person, there's the human element that is completely lost, that a lot of young generation people won't even comprehend and find awkward to be a part of that environment, you know, because it's again something that's like young people often, when I speak to them, like, yeah, why will I do that? That's like, that's so much work. I have to like travel and go through all of this and then like stand in lines, and maybe I can just, you know, put it on the screen and we can chill at home. I was like, damn, you know, and it sounds, at my age, it sounds okay, you know. Because I've been through it, but I have to remind myself, like, that process of, like, you're standing in the line, but you're having a conversation with other people that are attending the event. There's the energy of that moment that can't be, you know, even if you captured it on your phone, it's just doesn't equal the actual experience, you know. And so even when I was back home again, I like went out, and when I go back now again, I'm gonna go to like schools where young people are interested. Before, I used to do like full like assemblies, but with the attention span of young people, I'm like, nah, I'm gonna speak to the kids who really want to learn, you know, and then get that collective to benefit from the information, but also the economics attached to the information, because that's where young people, a lot of them, are at. Like, how do I survive? Which, you know, that's the truth of it. How do you make a living from the information and the people that have access to the products that are connected to the information, you know? And so, like, I want to go into schools, into libraries, communities, even like some creches that will allow me to bring, like, you know, colored in books, we call it, you know, that are localized, that have images from the community in it, you know? And so, because that, I feel, we've forgotten to that extent. We've forgotten that we need to be present. We need to be, and in truth, it's actually a space that is much more powerful, but also intergenerational. Right? I take my message to a school. The kid goes home. He tells his parents, the auntie, the uncle, the whole neighborhood gets to hear the story. It isn't just like it's online and I'm just talking to one person. You know what I mean? And so we forget that the story gets spread. It might not be exactly what it was, but it gets, you know, shared with the community. And a lot of people in South Africa also don't have access. When I was back the last time, we were 4 hours outside of Cape Town. We were out to school where there was essentially no internet, you know, and just because it was a rural school. And the kids' attention span, and, you know, we were there for 2 hours. We prepared dance sequences. We had them write their own lyrics, and we recorded a song in 2 hours, just under 2 hours. At the end of it, like, they performed. We shot a music video. The whole school was involved. It was so dope. It was like, this is what we do in Cape Town. It takes so many sessions, you know, because it's seen as something that young people, because in people's heads, it's like, now we can't do more than one song for the year. Here we were for 2 hours, we created a track with these kids, you know? And so I feel like after I spoke to those kids, like, how do I bring them to, like, when we spoke to them about coming to Cape Town, they were like, nah, Cape Town is a lot of gangsters, it's violent. My grandmother said never go there. I was like, damn. But then I remember when I took kids from Khayelitsha to Mitchell's Plain, it was the same fear, because the Xhosa kids have never really hung out with the colored kids. And so, like, it's necessary for us to break that divide, for us to bring people together, you know. Another thing I did was we recorded a music video with kids here in Atlanta. I played it to the kids in Cape Town, like, when they have their year-end Hip Hop as Healing Festival. They were like whistling and carrying on. And I asked them, yo, do you want this? Because I recorded while they were watching. And I asked, you want these kids to come and perform with you next year? And you're like, this whole room of like 500 kids, yeah. And so I played it for the kids in Atlanta. So they're trying to raise funds to, you know. So I feel like that's how you really solve the problem. You break the divides, but you also expand people's idea of family. You know, it's not just the people living next door. It's like the community generally around the world, you know, that's introduced to each other. So anyway, I'm going off on a tangent, but like, yeah, I feel like the in-person thing, especially coming from that history, it's still extremely important, you know, and to find a way to, like the kids were saying, yo, can we stream it so that our friends can see it around the world? So I was like, yeah, exactly, you know, yeah.
So for people who are hearing this, can you just say the name of the book and just like where people can get more information? Because I think your particular experience of translating that sort of on the ground work in hip hop with Black Noise from doing that kind of the concerts, you know, of course, at a very grassroots community level where you built out of, and then transferring that into an education process is very interesting for people to learn about. So maybe you could just talk about, like, very specifically if people would be interested in learning about this book.
There's actually three that exist at the same time. There's Making a Black Noise, part one, which is, like, from 1982 to 1995, you know, so just after the first election, and actually just after I went to Zulu Nation Anniversary in the U.S. So that's the first sort of documentation, right? Attached to that is a book called Creating Solutions. So I took all of the lessons from that period of time and I put it into a book so that kids can, you know, find like how the question is with a lot of young people, how did you leave your job and how did you like give up like the safety of a 9-to-5 and like what is, and in the book I mentioned like the mathematics of survival, like how do what I needed to do to pay the rent, to buy food and to survive, you know, and then like diversifying your income streams, to not think of one job, but to think of like, you know, like a diversification of like not only your creative ideas. So like a lot of rappers, they don't see writing as part of like the possibilities, you know, they like, I'm a rapper, I'm, you know, spit on the mic and record the song, but they don't see like the actually writing, you actually, you know, telling a story. And then at the same time, they like, in their mind, they're creating these images, which could be more than, like, it could be a music video, but it could also be like illustrated book, you know. So the Creating Solutions was that, like, how do people expand how their creative minds actually help them benefit economically, right, from a diverse, like, product creation, you know. And then the more recent one is a book about specifically the healing. So the more recent one is Hip Hop as Healing, which is with a couple of other, like Dr. Roberto Rivera from Wisconsin, another B-boy, Lacour, Fabian from New York. He has an organization called Hip Hop Education or Hip Hop Re-Education. And then there's this guy, Drew, that, like, essentially got the community to buy a flat and they have a dance studio in the basement. So everyone living above them is basically paying for the existence of the dance studio, which is dope. I was like, wow, yo, that's... So, like, all of these people are sort of an extension, like, after, you know, Making a Black Noise, Creating Solutions, is, like, how did this help us to heal? You know, how did these... of all these years of experience with hip hop help us to heal our like deep personal issues, you know? So those three more recently have sort of captured like where I'm intending to go. You know, I know that there's been talk that our students should be telling the next Hip Hop as Healing book, basically, like the how we passed it from ourselves to the next generation. You know, so it's been that's almost explains this idea of passing the baton, you know, like how do you, if you look at it, almost take it back to what's happened with the apartheid regime and the Elon Musk and Peter Thiel, like they've been passed that like rich baton of hate, and so you need a counter, you need to have the next generation of young people that's countering what exists, you know, and also be aware of what they're up against, you know, and why they're in the situation that they're in. Because I think a lot of times, like with apartheid, people thought, ah, it's over, you know, and like people are very like there's almost like the same way you watch movies, people are like, yo, that's the end. And, you know, energy doesn't travel in the same way, you know, that unless there's an equal and opposite force, which there never was to apartheid, that energy is going to just keep on traveling, you know. So that's what the book, I think, is like. Those three books explain that energy, that trajectory of, like, you know, like the lessons learned, the how do we share it with people in a concise manner, and how do we tell our story of the healing power of hip-hop. Because we're also confronted with this idea that hip-hop is rap industry, which is which is difficult for the kids who are in the rap world. They're like, yo, but I'm a hip-hop. And you're like, nah, someone is telling you one part of the story. Like, you're involved in the rap industry and the music to make money. You're not really, like, wanting to solve community problems, you know? And so I think that this hip-hop as healing helps challenge people. Like, a lot of people, they're like, what, a book about hip-hop and healing? Like, how does that, in their minds, because we forget that capitalist media has driven people to believe that rap industry is hip-hop.
That's a great point to end for this particular conversation, Emil. And, you know, to hear a little bit of context about your work across time. I encourage people to look up those titles and learn more about what you do. We'll share some links about your recent project, Hip Hop as Healing. Of course, your other works going back to the project Black Noise in Cape Town during apartheid. So thanks so much for talking today. That was a conversation with Emil YX, who is an artist and author, founder of Black Noise in South Africa, and has been involved in Heal the Hood Project. Thanks so much to Emil for being on this edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m., also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m. On CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. On CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. On Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. On CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. On CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. And on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also a podcast. Just look us up. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.